Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 38, titled Relative and Absolute, a conversation between Manjushri and Vimalakirti.
So it's a marvelous sutra. I always think of her as having an umbrella and shaking at the Buddha. I don't talk like, where have you come from? I didn't come from anywhere, Everything is just like, there's no coming, no going. Like the way that Manjushri and Vimalakirti talk to each other a little bit. So that's a kind of Ratnakuta Sutra. And the other thing I would just say, one of my favorite episodes is the one where the episode of Jagatim, well, a lot of them are my favorite, but the one I like about Jagatimdara, who is a layman, but he's meditating and he's sort of a little bit of a, he's on a retreat or something, and then the devil comes to him, Mara, the tempter, and he says, here, I'm going to bring all these maidens for you to entertain you and serve you. And Mara pretends to be Indra, the king of the Olympian gods in the Indian pantheon. And then Vimalakirti shows up and says, wait, that's not Indra. And you're a religious practitioner, and you shouldn't accept all those maidens. And this is really Mara. He's trying to tempt you and waylay you from your religious practice, your spiritual practice. And then Vimalakirti says, and therefore, Mara, you shouldn't try to pretend you're Indra and give all these girls to this Jagatimdara, but you can give them to me. So then Mara wants to run away. He says, no way, I'm not giving them to you. And he's going to run away, but then Vimalakirti has like a magical power and he can't move. So then all these celestial nymphs become Vimalakirti's servants and so on. And then Vimalakirti starts giving them teachings. And then he teaches them the delight in the Dharma, in the teaching, rather than delight in pleasures. And then they really get into that because they don't like being dragged around by Mara like some kind of a pimp, and dished out here and there to tempt this and that person. And they really get into it. And he gives them a big teaching. And then at the end, finally, Mara gets annoyed and says, "Well, listen, I want to leave now. You've done that." And then actually you're a bodhisattva, I've heard, you Vimalakirti, so if anybody asks you for anything, you give it to them. So then Vimalakirti says, yeah, okay, you can have them back. And then they get upset and they say, wait a minute, we don't want to go back there with him into that sort of pleasure house that he has. You just taught us about the Dharma and we're really into that, we like that. So don't do that to them. He says, oh, don't worry. And then he gives them that teaching called the inexhaustible lamp about how they can then go and then ruin Mara's house there, where he has all his pleasure thing and start telling people the Dharma, and then it becomes a place of spiritual practice. So this is typical Mahayana thing, you see. If you compare that with the episode in the Buddha's life where Mara shows up and he has only three girls there, his three daughters, and they try to seduce the Buddha and they fail and he sees them as hags or something or as corpses, walking corpses or whatever it is. And it's just he repelled, in other words, the sensory business, you see. So, in fact, showing his immunity to temptation of that kind. But in the Mahayana, instead of that, what they do is they say, okay, we'll take the girls, but then we'll turn them into Dharma practitioners. So it's like a more aggressive thing, if you see. It illustrates, in other words, what I was trying to say about how the Mahayana is not some kind of catering to something, and giving up some sort of monastic withdrawal from it all. It's a more aggressive changing the world itself that you confront, rather than just repelling it and pushing it away from you and saying, I'm leaving, going somewhere else. You follow me? So if you look at episode after episode, there's this type of parallel thing where Vimalakirti really is ranging all throughout. In a way, he's like an emanation of a Buddha, which is later it's revealed. He's like Shakyamuni Buddha, but instead of being the sort of keystone figure of an order of mendicants, of people dropping out of the ordinary society and changing themselves and creating a higher society and leaving the ordinary society as it is, hopeless and ordinary, so to speak. Instead of that, it is people aggressively trying to change the ordinary society as well, from the basis of a strong alternative community. If you follow me. So it sort of supports what I tried to tell you was the thesis that is not the popular thesis in the modern time, where people want to say that, oh, the Buddhism was collapsing after 400 years because nobody likes mendicants, which is kind of a very Protestant outlook, you know. People always project what they think of themselves. And this Protestant ethos, no free lunch culture that we live in, thinks of monastics or mendicants or people who withdraw from things as worthless people who are not productive, because we measure the value of the individual only by what they produce. And we can't think that there's some... therefore, that's why education is so expensive and so withheld to people. And the idea of people lifelong education is not a part of our culture. It simply is not. But that is not the way it is here in India. And so therefore, therefore, I just wanted to point that out about all those episodes. Now the chapters that relate to Prajnaparamita, or transcendent wisdom, the first of them is the chapter 5, where Manjushri and Vimalakirti meet. Remember, right? Finally, Manjushri says, I don't mind going, but I'll go talk to him. I can deal with him. He's extremely skilled in full expression and in the reconciliation of dichotomies. His eloquence is inexorable, and no one can resist his imperturbable intellect. He accomplishes all the activities of the bodhisattvas, etc. But although he cannot be withstood by someone of my feeble defenses, says Manjushri, who is the apotheosis, he's the angel, archangel of critical intellect, but he just says that anyway, humbly. Still, sustained by the grace of the Buddha, I will go to him and will converse with him as well as I can. And then all the wimpy people who wouldn't go, they all say, oh, let's go, that's going to be a great conversation between Manjushri and Vimalakirti. So they all tag along with him. And then this brings up another thing about the Vimalakirti and the Mahayana worldview, which is basically, it's a kind of... Now, the only way we can relate to it from our materialist culture and therefore our own consensual or common sense materialist feeling of reality that we have is as science fiction, really. How many of you know Doctor Who? Not too many. In America, people don't know Doctor Who. In Asia, they don't know Doctor Who. Doctor Who is the longest-running sci-fi serial, you know, on television anywhere in the world. And it's a British one. And he's been going since the 50s, longer than Star Trek. And Doctor Who is a Time Lord who comes from the end of the universe in the future and appears at different points in human history and sort of saves the day kind of thing. And he has 9 lives. He has 2 hearts and 9 lives. He's a different kind of being, like an alien. But he looks human. And, of course, therefore, he dies. He has 9 lives, like a cat. And he has died 8 times. The current Doctor Who is the 9th. Because they've had different actors play Doctor Who, it's been so long. And nowadays it's very high tech, if you see it on BBC, and very got a lot of great special effects. But in the old days, it used to be the enemies were these robot humanoid brains in robots who looked like Hoover vacuum cleaners. And they would go around going, exterminate, exterminate, and they weren't really that fearsome, but anyway, they were some very, very clever people from Oxford came to write the script. And they're very good sci-fi. Anyway, Doctor Who has a vehicle in which he time travels, which looks like a London police box, you know, phone box, and a police calling box, like a blue box, just as big as a phone booth, actually. And yet, when you go inside, it's a vast, huge thing. There's endless rooms, swimming pools, whatever, big machinery. So it has an infinite, it's like an expandable and inexhaustible space inside it. Well, here, Vimalakirti's house is just like that. Thousands of people go in the house. And later you'll see he brings these giant thrones in there, chairs in there that are like, you know, like miles high, and somehow they all fit in. So there's a big distortion of dimension going on, and all this sort of semi-magical stuff and miraculous stuff. And I don't know really what to make of it all. I still don't know really what to make of it all. But it's kind of, it's addressed actually in the 6th chapter of what's called Inconceivable Liberation, where the concept of that reality is what you make of it, and that the seeming real reality may not be so real. It's a little bit like a Matrix concept, actually. That's why I think I like those 3 movies, films, because they do sort of introduce people to the mass mind to the idea that this reality could be a computer creation and could be very different from what we think it is, actually. So it just introduces people to that to that concept. And that is definitely the Buddhist concept. And it's shown by these various things that violate the normal laws of gravity and space and time and all that, which he then addresses as well. Again, which one doesn't really know too well how to make of it, what to make of it, but we'll look into it. And but I'm not going to go into that at the moment, I'm just mentioning it. So therefore, when they all go with Vimalakirti, they go to a house that is a normal house in a town, and yet thousands of people go there, and they all go into the house. And then they freak out because the house is empty, and but it expands to encompass all of them somehow. So there is this element that runs through, and it's something to think about. So, of course, when they come, you have a prajnaparamita type thing. So when Vachavi Vimalakirti saw Crown Prince Manjushri, it addressed him thus. He said, Manjushri, welcome, Manjushri. You are very welcome. There you are without any coming. You appear without any seeing. You are heard without any hearing. So here you are, but you're not here, in other words. So he's getting right into it. If he'd done that in the Ratnakuta with that lady, she would have been very happy. She would have said, but where have you come from, even though you didn't come from anywhere? And then she would be, oh, that's right. Now you're dealing with ultimate, real reality. This paradoxical kind of thing. So then he agrees, Manjushri, he says, householder, it is as you say, who comes, finally comes not. Who goes, finally goes not. Why? Who comes is not known to come. Who goes is not known to go. Who appears is finally not to be seen. Now what does that mean? Now to illustrate this, I usually do my challenge. I do what I call the find your nose challenge. Now, you have a nose, right? You think you do. If somebody challenges you and says, well, show your nose, you will go like this. You'll put your finger on your nose, right? And that's what I'm doing. Now, what I'm touching, though, is that my nose? Well, in a way, it is, yes. But if I want to really find my nose, like really do a thought experiment and say, like, really, where's my real nose? Obviously, this patch of skin here, I could have a nose job. I could go, there's a lot of plastic surgeons here in New York. I could completely change my nose. And this piece of skin that I'm touching is therefore not necessarily my nose. It's like part of my nose. At the moment, sort of, I can say. But then when I say part of my nose, since I still haven't really demonstrated my nose, that doesn't help that much, or what makes me feel better. So then, what's the boundary between your nose and your cheek? Is there a line that says this is nose and this is cheek? If you run your finger from the bridge down to here, is there a moment where you know you're off nose and on cheek? Not really. So you'd make an arbitrary line. Then, as you know, lines don't exist because they have no width, right? They're an abstraction, right? To be a proper line, it can't be a small rectangle. If you draw a line with a pen, that's a narrow rectangle, right? Because it has width. Technically, a line has no width. A point, XY, has no size, right, to be exact point. A small circle is that, then there's different sides of the circle, right? You know, if you put a dot somewhere, that's not really a point, because it, you know, there's this side of the dot and that side of the dot and the other. Point, XY, has no size, right? So it's an abstraction, actually. But then that makes it exact, right, XY. So as an abstraction in our mind. So then the nostril, then is the air inside my nose, part of the nose or not? And then, again, if you look at skin with a microscope, it looks like the Grand Canyon, doesn't it? Where is the surface of skin? You know, pores become huge if you magnify them, right? So if you really try to find your nose, all you can do is come up with something that is not exactly your nose. So the nose is composed of a lot of parts. The unexamined nose, let's say, is composed of a lot of parts, none of which are the nose. Right? So what kind of an entity is the nose? It is an entity that is sort of there when you don't really look for it. When you really look for the nose, it dissolves under analysis, in other words. Then you can take your nose and throw it into an electron accelerator, just mentally. Don't really try to do that. And then if you do that, where are the atoms that are in the nose? Where are the subatomic particles that the atoms are in the nose? Is there a Higgs boson that's making you have a real nose with the volume of nose? Well, not really. Higgs boson is only judged to be there by some sort of secondary explosions that occur that they measure by computers, no one can see, and makes them, according to their theory, say that there's a Higgs boson there. Okay? So in other words, your nose, you can't find your own nose as a real thing that you can kind of pinpoint and it's sort of there. And don't think that, and we think, well, that's silly, of course, but I still have a nose. Yes, you have a nose if you don't really look for its real status of existence. You have a nose. But if you look for it to sort of verify, okay, that's really my nose, it will dissolve under analysis. Okay? And this is very threatening to people. Actually, for example, in the early 20th century, Bertrand Russell has a book, a philosophical book called Principia Mathematica, where he tries to say that, well, because there are these atoms that are sort of the indissoluble, indivisible building blocks of reality, we should be able to come up with notations that can deal with those particles of energy or whatever they are, that are the irreducible things that finally, you know, finally the empire is constituted of these things that we can really grip onto. And then if we have a notation system, mathematical and abstruse as it may be for only specialists, which are high priests, based on the culture, we can then diagram what they do, and perhaps we can learn to control them, and certainly own them. So the idea that atoms are individual particles, an ancient Western idea from the Greeks, and it was going on still in the early 20th century, and I would even say mostly today, even people, and Einstein in 1926 freaked out when the Niels Bohr and the Heisenberg and other quantum physicists in Copenhagen said, actually, when you really try to analyze anything, it disappears. So there's no way you can pin down at the very deepest level of magnification. When you really examine reality, it dissolves under, it's like water, and you're trying to pick up a handful of water. It just flows out of your hand. And then hand there is a lot of machinery, high-tech scientific machinery. But you can do that with thought experiment. And these people did that with thought experiment long before they had machinery. They had the machinery of the human brain and thinking and the optic nerves and things like that, but they didn't have any metal type of machinery. But they still came up with this idea, and they dealt with this idea, which is kind of a threatening idea. It means that what is it that we are and what do we really have? We have something that is sort of there and we can count on it as long as we don't really examine it, basically. But that is the definition of what they call conventional reality, illusory reality. That doesn't mean illusion reality, because illusory means like an illusion. So it is something there, but it is not what we think it is. This is a very key point. So Manjushri is agreeing with Vimalakirti. Vimalakirti first says, there you are without not being there. You have come without having come, etc. And then Manjushri agrees and says, who comes, finally comes not. Meaning, when you really look to see, well, did somebody arrive? Everything dissolves under analysis. The whole thing sort of melts into space. And your sense of, and the sense that we invest in things, that they're really real. As my old Mongolian teacher used to say, we are not wrong that things are real, but our problem is that we think they're really real. That's our problem. You know, we exaggerate, we invest an excessive degree of reality. And what they call is we invest, they have a lot of names for that thing that we invest habitually. And they call it self. And then you say, well, wait, I don't think my nose has a self. But I will say my nose itself. Oh, no, it's my nose itself something. So self is just a reflexive thing that seems to go back to something indissoluble and indestructible and essential about any entity that we perceive. And Plato, for example, he had this thing of the idea, the eidon, you know, the form, as they translate it in English, you know, some sort of pure thing, an abstract thing that then instantiates itself. So the nose-ness is manifested in a specific nose. And so the essence of the nose is something that exists in an intellectual heaven, like a nose-ness. So that's the real thing that makes the nose the nose. You know, that's the essence of it that makes the nose. Philosophers have done that for thousands of years, actually, in the West. And in India, too, a lot of them. But the Buddhist philosophers rejected that from the time of Buddha. And that's what he's referring to here. And this is the key of Prajnaparamita, the key of the concept of emptiness. That is to say, my nose is empty of an intrinsic reality of knowsness. It's empty of a knows essence. It's empty of an intrinsic objectivity. What does intrinsic objectivity mean? When you see the wall over there, you don't think that you are just interacting with some atom, subatomic thing, some wave, something that nobody really knows what it is, and somehow, therefore, this sense of its massive... there is a field called sociology of knowledge. They have a wonderful term that I like. You don't feel that what we see as, I mean, not just you, me, we see as the massive facticity of the wall. Don't you like that word? I really like that. It has a sense of massive facticity. In other words, like a big mass, like, you know, affectation. Do you know what I mean? That's a massive effect. It seems like I feel the table from its own side is going to be there as an object when I go like that. I don't feel that somehow while I'm interacting, and today I happen to hit it, like another day I might go through and do something. You know, because eventually we're both mostly empty atomic space, subatomic space, or even finally we don't know what we are. I don't feel that. I feel it has a massive facticity, massive objectivity, intrinsic reality, intrinsic essentiality, etc., etc., blah, blah, blah. All kinds of terms, intrinsic identity, we say. And it is, this we project, you can see it in history. People used to have wars with people who spoke another language. Because, you know, I speak English, that's a table, don't tell me it's a mesa. You know, some guy comes in and says, this is a mesa. No, it's a table, it'll come to blows. Especially if it's some big thing like God versus Allah. Oh, wait, oh, no, no, that's not God, that's Allah. Or that's Yahweh, or that's Vishnu, or whatever it is. You know, then bang, you know, life and death. Because that sense of the massive intrinsic objectivity of these things, which actually is our projection from the Buddhist point of view, just as sort of modern literary people like Derrida and others and his followers, you know, what they call deconstructionists, have kind of got into this in modern period. But these people were into this in ancient period, actually, from long ago. But, and then the modern people who get into this, like Derrida, a little bit post the late Wittgenstein and others, they get into where sort of they think that fits with existentialism and nihilism. So that since you can't find the nose, that what you have is nothing. But you don't have nothing. You can't find nothing either. You know, like when you look for your nose, if you can't find a real nose essence or intrinsic objective nose, intrinsically identifiable nose, intrinsically real nose, you haven't found an intrinsically real nothing. In other words, you're what they call your intrinsic reality habit. Your intrinsic reality projection habit with the dad. Intrinsic reality investment habit in things is wants to find something, so when it doesn't find anything, it then thinks that the nothing that is there, they have intrinsically really found. If you follow me, the habit makes the thing out of the nothing. But, for example, one of these ancient writers says, this is like a person who goes to a shop and says, give me some oranges, and the guy says, I don't have any oranges. Well, then give me the no oranges that you have. It's that silly. Yeah. So actually, that's a very important thing, because modern thing, there's a real nothing underlying our modern world, a real one that people think. And that's where we're all going when we die. They assure us. You know, people who think this former and future life thing is like some crazy religious fanatic thing. That's a fanatic thing that you're going to be nothing. Who ever found nothing? Where is nothing? Could I ask you? When you don't find something, you just don't find it. You didn't find nothing. Although you might say, well, I couldn't find anything, or I found nothing. I looked in here and I found nothing. But you didn't find nothing. You just didn't find what you were looking for. Okay? So that's what this is about. The Prajnaparamita. But emptiness doesn't mean nothing. What emptiness means is because my nose has no absolute essential noseness in there that makes it a nose. It's made into a nose by its relationship to the rest of my face, to my breathing, to the fact that I'm alive and I have to breathe, etc., etc., and also the language, I call it a nose, and I arbitrarily will say, well, I'll say this you know, I can't feel the nose bone anymore here, so I'll say this is a lion, etc. You know, I don't have a microscope, so I can just run my finger on the skin. I'll say, well, that's the surface, that's the boundary of the nose. In other words, I make all these arbitrary things, and conventionally speaking, I call it a nose, therefore it's a nose in a relative sense, empty of any non-relational essence that makes it a nose. You follow me? So what it's empty of is any non-relational essential existence as a nose. That makes it full of its relative existence. Which if I don't look too hard about having to make it like the real thing that I found, it's just a real thing that is there when I don't look for it. As I like to say, for most people, it's their lifelong hood ornament. I don't know, I like that. That makes me laugh. Okay, so that is what he's talking about here. So then he drops out of that. They both agree on this kind of, that this, their conversation is going to be on this plane of critiquing the habitual way of investing everything with the intrinsic realities, non-emptiness, sort of relative absoluteness, which of course is what makes people kill each other. This is my diamond, you know, not yours, you know, or when one gets obsessed, I have to have this, or I have to get that. It's because it connects to, these emotions get connected to this sort of over-exaggerated sense of the unchanged and absolute reality. And of course, the worst thing to have that feeling about is the self, my Bob Thurman-ness. So somebody says, you are a jerk, you're not Bob Thurman, you're a twit. Of what some kid will say, you're like Dodo Dada. And then I go, what do you mean? I'm Professor Bob Thurman. And some kid will throw something at me and make a joke. And if I'm too stuck on some fixed identity about myself, then I'm really having a hard time in dealing with the world. My identity habit, as the Buddhists would call it, is too intense, and it puts me at loggerheads with the rest of the world. So that's the most deadly one, is I'm the one, you know, basically. My old guru used to say that. Everybody runs around secretly thinking, I'm the one. naturally, when I saw Neo in the Matrix going, who's the one? Let's go see the Oracle and find out who's the one. You know, it really grabbed me. You know, it was really fun. But everyone is the one. Everyone is one of the ones. So then, you know, a lot of people in the early encounter with Buddhism, they thought the big news of Buddha was that nobody exists. Because of this idea of emptiness and selflessness. Well, if I have no self, then I'm not here. So they thought Buddha was running around saying, nobody exists. I'm not even here. Sometimes Buddha does say, there's no Buddha. Bhimakirti at one point said, he's standing in front of Shakyamuni Buddha. Buddha says, now you come here to see the Buddha. Now you see the Buddha. What do you see? And he says, I don't see the Buddha when I see some body in front of me. He says, to the Buddha, in the 10th or 11th or 12th, one of the chapter, I don't know which one, 12th, I think. He says that, meaning that on a deeper level, the reality level, a person who's Buddha identifies with the infinite universe. Therefore, you're just as much me as you are you. You're not inhabiting that body, but since you are a Buddha, the way that other people inhabit that, I'm really just what's here over here inside my skin, inside my consciousness. You're not like that. You identify with everything because you're a Buddha. So therefore, I don't see Buddha when I just see that body. I mean, in another context, he could say, well, I'm seeing an emanation body of Buddha, which is what Shakyamuni would be said to be, in the conventional relative reality, as a relational thing, which is not all of what Buddha is, he's admitted. Okay, so I think I made that point. So then they switch from that, and they go into being conventional, and they say, well, good sir, because that's why he came, to console the invalid, right? He says, is your condition tolerable? Is it livable? Are your physical elements not disturbed? And that this is sort of the stock thing about how you cheer up a sick friend. And then Bhimakirti gives a little bit non-stock answer, but now he doesn't give the absolute thing. He gives the compassion answer, the way of dealing with this relativity. Because once you realize that there is no absolute outside of relative things, once you realize the law or the principle of relativity, which is what emptiness means, then what the condition of the relative becomes all important in a way it has absolute importance to you. So then if anybody's suffering in the relative, that becomes something of absolute importance. So that's why they say that the wisdom of selflessness or emptiness becomes a compassion, you know, universal compassion within relativity, within the interwoven field of relative beings. So Vimalakirti is saying that right away because he is a bodhisattva. He does have understanding of emptiness and meaning slash relativity. And he says, Manjushri, my sickness comes from ignorance and the thirst for existence, and it will last as long as do the sicknesses of all living beings. Were all living beings to be free from sickness, I also would not be sick. In a way, that's a claim of enlightenment that he's making there, but not in the saying, I am enlightened. He's just saying, he's explaining what that consciousness feels like. Why? Manjushri, for the bodhisattva, the world consists only of living beings, and sickness is inherent in living in the world. Were all living beings free of sickness, the bodhisattva would also be free of sickness. For example, Manjushri, when the only son of a merchant is sick, both his parents become sick on account of the sickness of their son. And the parents will suffer as long as that only son does not recover from his sickness. Just so, Manjushri, the bodhisattva loves all living beings as if each were his only child. He or his or her, they should say. Oh, in Sanskrit, it's an inflected language, so there are male and female suffixes on declensions on nouns, and they do say in their grammatical rule, just like in English when you say he or you say man, people are supposed to understand mankind, and therefore it includes the female. But actually there's a hidden chauvinism in that fact, but it's there in Indian language as well. So one does literally translate he, but nowadays I don't. I translate he or she. Or when one goes, one becomes sick when they are sick. So you go, you know, one tries to get around not doing that nowadays. As a translator, I have decided I do that last 3 or 4 decades. But this time I was still just being literal. So you ask me, Manjushri, whence comes my sickness? The sicknesses of the bodhisattva arise from great compassion. And so then they go into one of these dialogues. Manjushri, householder, when he starts seeming to be matter of fact, he says, well, why is your house empty? How come you have no servants? Where's your butler, etc.? He's a wealthy man. Where's your maid, your butler, your family, you know? And but Vimalakirti doesn't answer on that level. He just says, Manjushri, all Buddha fields are also empty. What makes them empty? Well, they're empty because of emptiness, which is not really an answer. And then he says, well, what is this? So then Manjushri, what is empty about emptiness? And he says, well, constructions are empty because of emptiness. So in other words, constructions happen, but then they are empty because they're nature, and they're able to happen because of emptiness. So you can have a concept of non-empty because of emptiness. In other words, emptiness enables relativity. And everything that we do, even in the concept of the absolute that we have, is enabled by the fact that our mind is a relational thing. If any entity were absolute, it couldn't relate to any relative thing. So actually, although there's a lot of questioning in Buddhist history of how can the world function if it's all empty, and the answer is, how could it function if it wasn't empty? You follow me? It shows how emptiness is definitely different from nothingness. It means relativity. Because absolute means the opposite of relative. So this is a critique of all kind of theistic ideas also, because people will say, well, God is absolute. Oh, well, he created the world, but he's absolute. And he created it without relating to it. Well, of course, then you're just saying, well, your mind cannot function. The meaning of the word absolute you don't use. In that case, you take a word which is an emphasis word and make it into having an absolute meaning, which it cannot have. You know, an absolute thing can't do anything relevant to a relative thing without becoming relevant. It's a simple, it's almost like a tautological thing for a rational philosopher, and that these people are trying to be, up to a point, actually. You can't say they're perfect. Nobody's perfect.